Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile. With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. I bet you get 30, 30, I bet you get 30, I bet you get 20, 20, 20, I bet you get 20, 20, I bet you get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month, sold.
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Hello, this is Ramesh Ranganathan. Welcome to Hip Hop Saved My Life. I'm speaking to you from a hotel lobby in Ethiopia. Excuse the background noise. I sound like a journalist or something. Anyway, what to tell you about today's episode. So today's episode was with Mr. B, the Gentleman Rhymer. If you don't know Mr. B, I suggest you check out. He's basically combined hip-hop with kind of like, I don't know, steampunk or something. He used to be in Collapse Lung, knows his hip-hop backwards, and was great fun. So, great fun. It sounds like the most fucking nondescript thing you could say. He was brilliant, okay? I don't need to talk about it anymore. Enjoy hip-hop, save my life. Oh, and the other thing I forgot to say is, you've seen the new artwork. It's great. Thank you to Stuart Cromick for that. I've got to be honest, I'm not happy with this intro, but I can't be asked to re-record it, so deal with it. Bye-bye.
This is the Hip Hop Save My Life podcast. Thank you for listening to the podcast. Hope you enjoy the podcast. Now sit back because it's time for the podcast.
Welcome to Hip Hop Save My Life. I'm with Roo Maj. I want to apologise to you.
Oh God!
Because I had a meeting yesterday about something completely different, and the person I was having the meeting with said, "Really enjoy the podcast, except for the fact that you're really horrible to Roo Maj." He said to me, "You're really horrible to him," and also he sounds quite down about it. And I just said, "He just sounds like sad sack. Like that is how you sound, isn't it? It's not like." Oh, you sound like life is beating you just all the time, don't you? That's not like...
Yeah, it's not a character.
So anyway, today I'm
going to
be...
Who was this guy?
It's a TV producer. So I'm going to be nice to you today.
Oh, thank you.
Like for today's podcast.
I won't know what to do with myself.
Well, you always know what to do yourself because you're such a quick-witted and fast thinker.
Thanks. Now we're both under pressure.
Yeah. And we were just talking with our guest, who I'm about to introduce, about the fact that you're not... You can't get into honey.
We were talking about that before you bring it up.
I want to bring it up. Why are you trying to get
I into never honey? Liked it back in the day.
Right.
Like, you know, when I was first on the honey scene.
Yeah.
And then my girlfriend's a big honey fan.
Right.
So I just thought I'd make an effort.
Does she get the honey with the
squeezy bottle one? Is it Miels? Miels?
I don't know. I don't eat honey, Matt. I'm vegan.
Oh, shit.
But my mum loves the one where they actually not only happy with stealing the honey, but they also take a bit of the bee's house and stick it in the jar. You've seen that one?
Yeah.
My mum loves that. So just fucking, she'll just
couple of bees
it
flying
out
when
Winnie
first
the Pooh,
it.
And then just fucking savage this bit of beeswax, just chomping away on it. It's rank. But anyway, the reason that was brought up is because we are honoured and delighted to have the pioneer of chap hop himself, Mr. B, the Gentleman Rhymer. How are you?
Very well, sir. Very well. Thank you for having me along.
Thanks for coming. You are a honey fan, right?
That's nothing to do with your... That's not why you're called Mr. B, is it?
No.
Wow.
I was going to let you have that one, mate.
That was...
It's easy.
Did you feel the electricity?
For one moment there, you decide not to be horrible to Rumaj, and he's taken over.
Just so you know, that's what happens when you're not happy. Like when you're not nice, when you're nice to him, he's encouraged to drop dog shit like that. Yeah. That's what happens. Anyway, you had honey, right?
I did have honey this morning. Yes.
What type? Do you get like artisan?
No, it's you know just from down the whatever the Sainsbury's local thing. Squeezy,
right.
Squeezy bottle
guy.
Okay. Fine.
Just one of those. I wanted peanut butter, but we'd run out.
What do you go for, crunchy or smooth?
Crunchy, generally.
Yeah, I do too. What about you, Rimaj?
I don't really eat peanut butter.
No?
I'm just a Marmite guy.
Are you? Mm. And what do you have with a Marmite?
Butter.
Right. Mm. Have you ever tried pre-mixing it?
No. What, so you'd melt the two together?
You don't melt the two together. You get a little bowl. This is great for the... By the way, this is very hip-hop, isn't it?
Yeah.
But anyway, you get a little bowl.
Yeah.
Put some butter in it, or margarine, if you don't, like, eat dairy.
And then you put some Marmite in it and you mix it up in the ratio that you want.
Yeah.
And you make Marmutter.
I'm in.
Yeah?
I'm 100% in.
All right, cool. I've tried it.
Yeah?
It's great. It makes absolutely no fucking difference. So yeah. It's utterly pointless.
It's more work, evidently.
But for some reason, the theatre
yeah.
of mixing it up makes you feel good.
But isn't that part of the joy of having the butter on
yeah,
first and then
melt it
Marmite?
On.
Because you never know where the butter's going to spread to underneath. You get a little surprise hit of butter.
Yeah, I think you might be right, actually. Have you tried... and this is something I can't have. I don't know why I keep going about what I can't... Anyway, the point is, somebody told me that cheese on toast with honey underneath is banging. Have you tried that?
I have not, no.
No,
has anyone tried beans on toast with some peanut butter?
No.
No way.
It's
like
working.
Sort of satay beans on toast.
Is it really?
Oh, it's good.
I like eating... Go on.
I was just going to say, that sounds appalling, but is it worth a try?
Well, I'd say it's worth a try.
Right. Okay.
I'm not saying it's not appalling, but I didn't find it appalling.
Right. Okay.
So, you know, it's worth a go.
I like eating cold baked beans and mixing mayonnaise into it. Still.
Right.
From
so,
when
but
I was
but
like
the way
12.
You the way you said that was yeah. like that you start eating the baked beans and then you're sort of mixing the mayonnaise into as you're eating it.
Just from the tin.
Just sort of,
similar to your Marmite.
Just sort of sitting with the bowl just
another squirt.
Never eat it.
So, Mr. B, listen, we are big fans of
yes.
you on this podcast.
Thank you. I'm very happy to hear that.
And you you have proper hip-hop credentials. If you haven't listened to his stuff, it's great. There's sort of a mix of, like, you sort of do chap-hop covers of hip-hop stuff, but mainly you do your own thing, don't you, basically?
Yes, yes. I suppose that's the thing. I'm, a lot of people saw my... You know, my chap hop history video on YouTube's got
yes.
lots of hits and that sort of thing. So people tend to think, I'm always getting people saying, oh, why didn't you do a cover of this? Why didn't you do a cover of this? Like, all my albums are just my stuff.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, that typical sort of up myself artist thing. Oh, no, how dare you? I do original things as well.
But I think it's, you know, even taking your, like looking at your covers that you do, it's not just like... You just do it in your voice. You actually you completely change it, don't you? I mean, you can recognise a tune, but you change the lyrical sensibilities of it and everything.
Yes.
You do put a lot of work into it, don't
well, absolutely,
you?
Absolutely, yeah. And it's an homage. It's that sort of thing that, you know, the whole problem with doing supposedly funny hip-hop is that
yeah.
you have to walk that fine line between parody and homage and that sort of thing, which
well,
hopefully I just, you know,
yeah,
I'm on the right side of that.
I definitely do think you do that. I think, like, one of the things with sort of hip-hop parody or whatever that is annoying is it's like mostly done by people that you don't feel have a genuine affection for it.
Of course, yeah.
And so you sort of have like an outsider sort of aping what they think hip-hop characteristics are, and it's always
yes.
really horrible and shit. And I think I don't think you've even come close to looking like you're sort of not a hip-hop fan. I think that definitely comes across, certainly from my point of view.
Good.
And I believe I can speak for Roo Madge.
You can, yeah.
He 100%. Looks like he's agreeing with me there, so that's
he
great.
Does.
Yeah, and
yeah.
well done for sort of giving me that signal, Roo Madge. You're doing great. but yeah, so I think that's fair to say. How did sort of chap-hop come about?
It was sort of a culmination of everything I'd done before. Because
right.
I'd been in a hip-hop band, things like that. And I'd done.
What were they called?
I was in Collapse Lung.
Yeah.
I replaced our friend Nihal.
Yes. Good.
When he left.
If you're listening, Nihal, we've got the guy that fucked you off, mate.
Why did he leave?
Well, I think he wanted to do his own thing.
Right.
Just,
yeah.
You know.
Did he go on and do the Muddy Funksters?
He did Muddy Funksters. Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah. yeah. yeah. yeah.
And yeah, I think I signed to Go Beat and that sort of thing. But yeah, just sort of. Yeah, but I think he had other plans.
Yeah, yeah, sure.
So I just slightly by accident ended up joining Collapse Lung just because I'd seen him play a few times and really liked them.
Yeah.
And then I was around my friend Haytham, who's a rapper from Sensor, if you remember Sensor.
Yes, I remember Sensor, yeah, yeah.
Yes, and they're still playing. But I was around at his place and we were just sitting reading the NME, as people, I think, used to do.
Yeah.
And then, there was a little thing about how Nihal had left Collapse Lung and I said, I could do that. Just kind of as a joke.
Yeah.
And he went, you could do that. And he gave me Ant's number.
And amazing. Did you originally think that you were going to do it as yourself, or did you anticipate browning up and sort of really taking on Nihal's mantle?
No, I was, you know, obviously conscious that I wasn't going to do that. That probably wasn't going to work out.
Did it occur to you
well.
At any moment, not at all?
I don't think so.
No, okay, fair enough.
Obviously, I felt that I needed to take on certain characteristics of Nihal.
Yeah.
But I was hoping that would come across in sort of, you know, stagecraft and that sort of thing.
Got you.
You know, I may have failed, I may have succeeded, I don't know. But
that was good.
But we went off in another way.
How much did you want to be in Collapse Long? A lot.
I think I did at the time. It was it was just sort of, but I had that feeling that I could have, I just had that feeling that I think this is actually going to happen.
Yeah.
I thought it was a bit, you know, out there to actually try and join a band that had got a deal and things like that.
Hadn't been in about anything before?
I'd been in a band and that sort of thing. I left that band. They weren't that happy about it. Really.
Yeah.
They were fine. But
they replaced you with Nihal, didn't they? The Muddy Funks.
Oh, yes, exactly. We're called the Muddy Funks, as we were called.
But that is quite... was it a bit of a sort of a headfuck to sort of read about a band in NME... And then next thing you know, you're sort of like talking about joining the band as like the lead vocalist.
And the next thing you know, I spent a whole weekend in Harlow recording.
Yeah.
They sent me some demos and I put some, you know, put some bars over the top and that sort of thing. And then they said, well, come up to Harlow, we'll just get them demoed properly and what have you. So I spent a whole weekend there. Don't remember sleeping. Right. Remember doing the last bit of vocals on the like Monday morning at like 8 o'clock or something like that. I think we were just playing lots of pool and things like that at the Square in Harlow, which is now gone, sadly. And then I think Steve from the band gave me a Collapse Lung t-shirt and just said, I think that means you're in the band. There was never any kind of... There wasn't a big ceremony apart from the handing over of the Collapse Lung t-shirt.
Right. And did you... Because listen, I don't have the illustrious hip-hop career that you do, but I remember, like, a DJ, like a mate, hooking me up with a producer and going, oh, my mate Rom raps, like, do you want to go and... And I remember turning up to this guy's bedroom, and we were just talking about it before we started recording, but with, like, the coat hanger and the tights stretched across it. And he goes to me, right, let's see what you can do. That first moment when you're about to start is the most terrifying...
It's absolutely terrifying, yes.
I mean, that must have been horrific, right? For you, you more so, because I was just in front of two guys from Horsham, whereas you were in front of Collapse Lung, right?
Yes. Well, the thing is that, I mean, luckily I'd demoed, you know, I'd sent them some bits on a tape anyway.
Yeah.
That they'd sent me some beats and I'd sent them some rhymes back and what have you. So they kind of knew the stuff already. The worst bit was after that when we'd go straight into demoing in the studio and I'd have to write new things. So the first time they'd hear any of it was just me stood by the mic. And they were like, you know, and they kind of, they were at the point when, you know, they'd had a couple of EPs out and they had gone down really well and, you know, Nihal had left and they got a lot of press and things like that. So there was a certain pressure situation there. I was just thinking, oh God, what's going to happen? You know, luckily they didn't ever really say either way whether they liked it or not.
Right. That's horrible, because I know that after gigs and stuff, even now, it's like when you finish and you don't want to let on that you need a pat on the head, but you do. Do you know what I mean? So you sort of finish and look around the room and everyone goes, right, that's finished then. And you go, okay.
Well, that was what my first Collapse Lung gig was like, really. It was sort of... Came off stage and I was really hyped up and I had a great time and I thought the gig went really well and I'm kind of like, I think we should maybe do this differently and that, you know, they were already in that, just slightly cynical about the whole thing. And I was like, I'm in a band, we just played a festival in Belgium. And they're like, I don't think, you know, I think you sounded a bit overexcited there in bits of it.
You're agreeing with
all of it.
You know,
maybe I might change that bass line.
Cool,
good
guys.
Stuff. Cool, this is good.
After your recording session?
Well, so what happened was it got put straight onto the mixtape.
Yeah.
And then the mixtape went out. Mm. And then, actually, it's quite an embarrassing thing that happened to me. And this guy, DJ Doe, he just got in touch with me recently. And I don't think he'll admit this, but I know this to be true because of the way that everything panned out, is that I went down there and I did a couple of tracks like about a month apart, just like freestyle, it was shit. But they were like, oh, that was really good, and put it out. And then the last time I'd gone to see him, he goes, I've got this beat, and he sent me the beat, and I said, I've written something for it. And as I was doing it, I don't know if this has ever happened to you, I just realised that what I'd written was awful. Like, it was sort of like I was at I was sort of in his little sort of makeshift studio and doing it, and he turned to me and he goes, Do you want to give that another go? Do that again? So I do it again.
Write it again.
Yeah. But that's what he wanted to say. So I'll just deliver the same turgid dog shit again. And then he goes, cool, man. I'll speak to you soon. And then it never came out, nor did I ever hear from him again until like a month ago.
So he's threatening to release it like a celebrity mixtape?
No, he didn't say
that. Well, not a celebrity sex tape, celebrity mixtape. Ramesh in celebrity mixtape
shame. Let's get it.
Doe, if you're listening to this,
send it.
Can you send it under the cover of night.
We'll post it on YouTube. Like,
by horseback.
Put it on YouTube.
I don't want there to be any danger.
It's probably quicker just to post it on YouTube.
No, do not post it on YouTube, mate. Do not post it on YouTube. So Collapse Lung. Then,
yes.
So then what happened?
Collapse Lung.
How many albums? That,
we had two albums out. Obviously, we released... I turned up and we had a little studio in Clerkenwell, and I turned up there one day, and Johnny, the bass player, just said to me, do you want to have a track used on the new Coca-Cola advert for the Euro 96 thing? And I
the
said...
Dream.
Yeah. I said, yeah, OK, that sounds good. No, no rules, I know you know fools, we're in love with a beautiful game with no shame, that's cool.
Had you written Eat My Goal at this stage?
Yes, it was on the first album.
Right.
And it wasn't... That's the whole thing. Eat My Goal's not about football at all.
No.
It's kind of about blagging and having nothing to say at all. Yeah. Generally, my entire career has been about just having nothing whatsoever really to say about anything. But, we did that. And I remember that day going down there. It was a Lexus garage at the end of the road.
Yeah.
And so we all went down there looking around at cars, going, oh, I think I'll have that one. And then literally a year later, the band had split up. I was phoning my accountant to ask him if I was in a position to be able to sign on the doll. Because I was totally brassing.
Eat my doll.
And I actually had to...
this guy, he said, eat my doll. This guy's... You are smashing lives,
man.
You, honestly,
it's
I'm not just
coffee
saying
this. And the positivity.
You have contributed more to this episode than you have to the entire podcast since we started.
Oh, right.
I mean, that's
we're
a compliment.
There.
No, you're smashing it.
You are smashing it.
I mean, it does Thanks. Suggest that you've been dog shit on every other one. But no, you, great work. Sorry, Mr. B.
Still trying to keep you slightly in your place
Yeah.
Just a little bit.
Just.
It's the coffee, isn't it? I'm fucking hyper.
Yeah.
Anyway, carry on, sorry.
I've stuck with the tea.
Yeah.
So I phoned my accountant to ask if I could go. I actually had to phone him back because he was laughing so much. He thought the whole thing was hilarious. So, and that was the thing. We do that thing often. You know, we had Eat My Goal, did well. Then we released another track after that, and we were really pleased with it. Spent a bit of money on a video, and nothing.
Yeah,
it was just it disappeared. It sold less than all the sort of little indie ones we'd had out, and that's
right.
And so we'd start turning up at shows, and you know, the audience would be bouncing about and what have you. We'd play Eat My Goal, they'd go spare. And then we'd have another few songs to finish off the set while people were just drifting off. And that's all, they're just drifting off gradually. Okay, fine.
You did that.
So we did all that stuff, yes. And then after that, what did I do after that? We sort of started another little band with, some of the same members called Junior Blanks, which kind of, we didn't really go anywhere, but we did a couple of albums worth of material, which is quite good. And then I did some stuff under the name of Sergeant Rock and got signed to Ouija Records and had, again, that was another one that, there ended up being lots of stuff used on TV because it was a slightly big beat sort of, it was that, turn of the century, big beat, break beat sort of thing for a while. Then I moved to Brighton and I started a little band, I took up the ukulele.
Right.
And started a little band down there and just doing sort of odd covers on the banjolalee and what have you. But anyway, Mr. B sort of started, which was kind of a culmination of all these things. And I was, I was looking for a way to, I wanted to dress better.
Right.
And that sort of thing. It was my excuse. It was my roundabout way of just, rather than just, put a suit on, maybe buy a suit, put a suit on, I had to create this entire world just for the fact that I wanted to wear a suit to the pub.
Right.
And we did try and implement a thing with some friends. We always, meet up for a drinky and I tried to implement suit autumn. Like after summer, if we went out for a drink, we'd wear suits. But
right, how did that go?
It went fine, but I was the only one that did it.
So it didn't go fine then? You just wore a suit to them?
Well, it went fine for me.
Right.
I don't think I was actually thinking of anyone else at all. They were just people who happened to be there.
Yeah, yeah.
So I thought, sod it, if I can, we can pretend this is a thing.
And then did the tash, when did the tash come?
Yes, well, the tash...
Because it is, by the way, beautiful.
Tremendous. Thank you very much.
It is absolutely beautiful. What product are you using in that?
This is Au Naturel.
Is it really?
I wake up in the morning and it's there. Phew.
Great.
It actually gets worse during the day. When I first wake up, I think you've been lying on it.
Right.
So it's been squished to your face. When I wake up, it's usually, that's the best moment.
Wow.
And then I have a shower and
it's all
goes on. Could
you tweet us, could you send me a photo of it?
I will send you a photo. Well, yeah, exactly. Straight off the pillow. I will send you a picture. Well, no, the first Mr. B gigs, well, I thought I'd bring the whole thing together. So I did a track called A Piece of My Mind. There's a video of that on YouTube and that sort of thing. I thought, I'll just give this a go.
Yeah.
I put it up on a MySpace page because it was 2007.
Yeah.
And then someone just, I think first of all, I was also in a little hip-hop band called Button Up with a guy from Belfast, a friend of mine. And we ended up touring in Japan. And they'd heard of some of the Sergeant Rockstar. This is really round. This is good.
I'm
going round the houses here.
This is good.
But they, you know, these guys, these Japanese guys that put these gigs on, were sort of music geeks, and they'd heard the Sergeant Rock stuff.
Right.
And then they sort of said, oh, we'd like to put a Sergeant Rock track on there. And because I hadn't done a Mr. B page yet, I put this up on the Sergeant Rock page. And they said, oh, we want to use this one, The Piece of My Mind. I was like, oh, right. Well, that's actually Mr. B, the Gentleman Rhymer. So the first actual release of Mr. B was on a Japanese compilation CD thing for this label called Second Royal in Osaka.
My good man, have a care. Your misuse of apostrophes is preposterous to me. It offends my very soul, for my brogues, my bowler. It's a whole lot of guff, and it makes me want to take it roughly. But it appeals of your blazer and hazer. You're all rude to me, it eludes me how you can be so unruly. And truly believe you can enter Club Barretta. So you'd better bust a move, or you'd be trussed up to it with an inch of your life. And I'll say to the doorman.
So after that, I got back and then someone asked me to play a gig.
Right.
So I thought, okay, and I had a bit of a beard on the go at the time, so I just, you know, shaved the bottom bit off,
yeah.
Left the tash.
Yeah.
And then gradually I got more and more gigs, so that became impossible to do.
Right.
And so the moustache stayed, but it was at that kind of slightly rubbish sort of Ian Beale moustache stage. And it wasn't until I got to twirling stage when everything fell into place.
Right.
I was like, okay, now this is, okay. And I thought, I couldn't really have this moustache with just a T-shirt and jeans.
No.
So I started just dressing like that as well. So the whole thing.
So your whole lifestyle changed essentially.
In a way, yes.
Yeah. Do you feel that do people respond to you differently dressed like that?
I guess so. Well, I guess in a way, I've dressed like this for so long. I don't know how they would respond to me if I wasn't dressed like this.
Yeah.
But yeah, I think so. I'm a, you know, I get hecklers at gigs, but they tend to be, you know, very polite heckling. Like I was one that someone just shouted, "Adequate."
Because they're gentlemen.
Tend to do that. Yeah. Yes, exactly. Yeah, because people tend to, you know, the whole thing is this very terribly like innocent, gentlemanly thing. That I don't tend to get people swearing at me and things like that.
What are your crowd like? Who do you get?
All sorts, really. I mean, it seems to span generations. You get sort of, you know, teenagers coming along that said that their granddad first introduced them to me or something like that, or that sort of thing. So, you know, it can span the generations. I guess there's all these facets of it that people can take what they like from. People like the banjolele, I think lots of kids love the banjolele because it's got a sort of silly sound. And you get people that like the hip-hop bit of it or the people that like the chappiness of it and that sort of thing. So it tends to be a bit of a, mix.
And who do you do all the stuff yourself? Or how do you do it?
Yes, it's all me.
That's pretty amazing, man.
Yes, but this is one of those weird hip-hop things that you always feel that, you know, within hip-hop there's that very much. It's a thing with Kanye that he's like a producer and a rapper. If he's a he's a producer that started rapping.
Yeah.
So people, you immediately, in your hip-hop head, just say, he must be a rubbish rapper then.
Yes,
And I kind of find I battle with that myself. But at the same time, I was always a huge Prince fan. I always loved that, you know, the fact that he just did everything.
Yeah.
And I always wanted to do that. So it's nice, you know, this is the first time really I've been able to create this whole little world that's just mine.
Yeah.
And have a good old muck about with it.
Well, it's very, very impressive.
Oh, thank you.
The track, all of your stuff's great, but there's one particular, because the thing is that I think that the thing about what you do is that initially people are drawn in by the musicality and how different it sounds to anything else. And also there's a comedy element to it as well.
Yeah.
But the other thing is you actually sort of do tackle some quite real things, I guess, like through in a funny way. The one track that I wanted to talk to you about is the Hip Hop Was to Blame After All.
Okay, yes, yeah.
And I think that track, it sort of encapsulates the whole argument so beautifully, man. Like this thing about hip hop getting blamed for the misogyny and all of this, and actually that sort of you sort of talk about how, well, your closing line is about, you know, you're sort of ironically blaming hip-hop for all the ills of society and then say, you know, it's the fault of hip-hop and not the fault of the three record companies that are in control of everything you listen to, basically.
Exactly, yes.
hip-hop decided to homogenize itself and base itself in violence and wealth. Hip-hop decided to pick out its lowest traits and sell them to the public over everything that's great. Hip-hop decided that misogyny and greed would be the sort of thing that America would need. Hip-hop worshipped the cult of me. Hip-hop chose to ignore Chuck D. Hip-hop's a $40 billion industry, so now all the ghettos live in prosperity. Traded power for visibility. Let hip-hop become a new colony.
That track is amazing, sort of the what you get across there. It's a really succinct way of putting the argument across.
That is probably what, you know, maybe the track that I'm most proud of as far as that sort of thing goes. Because it's, you know, I usually, especially when you, you know, when you're rapping, it's, you know, in a kind of little pop song, you can condense things quite nicely in a few words. But obviously, if you're dropping bars all over the shop, you've got 48 bars to get through loads of extraneous nonsense before you get to the point.
Yeah.
But that one was, you know, a little bit shorter and sweeter and that sort of thing. But it was, I think that was the whole thing. You know, as you say, it's sort of, I'm glad that it sort of encapsulated that whole argument well, because it was, but the thing is, people, the nature of YouTube is people often like, oh, we'll watch this for a bit.
Yeah.
And they'll watch that, you know, up until the last 5 seconds. They're like, what a fascist. And I've had people on Twitter going, you're a fascist. You can't sit there and, you know, as a posh, you know, white Englishman and blame hip hop for everything.
Yeah.
You're like, please listen to the end.
Have you seen that new video for I'm Not Racist? Have you seen this video where it's like Joyner Lucas, I think it is?
No, okay.
Where he does the arguments of racist white people.
Yes, I have seen that.
And then he does a counter-argument from the black community. But the video is two guys, like this redneck-looking white guy and this like black guy just sitting opposite each other. And the first bit is the white arguments, right? So, but he gets the white guy to, he's not in the video. Mm. He gets the white guy to mime he does both bits. But what it looks like when you click on that video is just this really racist redneck that can fucking spit fire. Like, it's just so bad. Do you know what I mean? Like, the first thing
people in the comments sort of reacting to that.
Yeah, I think like when it first came out, people were just like, who the hell is this guy? This is like crazy. And then eventually people sort of got it. Do you know what I mean?
Mm.
But I think he's still got some shit for it, though, hasn't he? Like, because they were sort of saying that, I think the racist arguments were a bit too persuasive or something. I mean, he is a black guy, but I think it actually contributed to it. I think a couple of people went,
Well, also because it's on the internet. So,
yes, you know, that is the main factor, isn't it? Yeah, sorry.
I found that actually recently. I think in my Just Like a Chat video, I've suddenly got a swathe of hatred.
Really?
From, I don't know if it's from one source and all his pals or something like that. So everyone's like, I fucking hate this guy. I hate this shit. This is the lamest thing I've ever seen. No, God.
Just,
no, I learned that early.
Just click on the thumbs up on the comment. Yeah.
Have you ever responded to anything like that?
Yeah, I think I did a while back. I think there was a whole thing with my dear chum, Professor Elemental.
Yes.
Who, you know, we had our little chap off thing.
Yes.
And when he released his fighting trousers, a lot of people just took it very seriously.
Right. And they thought you really had beef.
Yeah, I think so, yeah. I think there may have been a mild bit of beef, as much as, you know, we met each other at a Public Enemy gig at Brixton when they were doing the Nation of Millions, you know,
doing the whole album. Yes, just playing the album from top to bottom.
Playing the album, yes. And then we didn't see each other maybe for a year or so, year and a half after that. And I think he just had loads of people, you know, coming up at gigs saying, oh, I really like that one about cricket you do, and things like that. I mean, I got the same thing, you know, I like your tea one. So I think you go, that's the other guy. And I think he just, but you know, we went for a drink after he'd done it, and he said, look, you know, I'd always wanted to do a diss track. And, you know, there wasn't anyone that turned up until me that he could, you know, make it relevant.
Yeah. So you're friends now?
Oh, yeah. We're all chummy. Yeah. But we still, everyone, you know, lots of people still sort of say, oh, you know, we'd like to put you and Professor Elemental, and maybe you could do a battle. And,
oh, God.
Do we have to? Can we just... So, yeah, we do a lot of shows together, but we'll end up just doing a couple together at the end and that sort of thing.
Right.
We were talking about doing an EP together or something like that, but just never end up getting around to it, you know.
Were you at the Public Enemy? I don't know if it was that gig that you took, because I was at that gig.
Right.
Well, I went and see them on that tour. But there's one gig, and I don't know if it's that one, I don't think it was, where somebody just hurled a can of Red Stripe at one of the S1Ws. Like, they were doing, they were doing their thing, just suddenly you just see this fucking just full can just twat one of them straight in the chest.
Did he carry on doing his march?
Clear the way for the S1Ws, man. I don't give a shit.
Clear the way.
Red Stripe isn't going to stop them. Are you crazy? You think you can stop the revolution with Red Stripe? Fuck you, mate. They just carried on. Actually, to be truthful, Flavor Flav really lost his shit about it. He wasn't happy.
Finished up the can.
Why would you be? You wouldn't go, oh, that's funny.
No.
But I always found Public Enemy gigs. I mean, I've been to so many of them.
Mm.
There's one. I don't know how many times you've been to see him. But,
quite a few. But actually, this is an embarrassing story about me meeting Chuck D. I think we played in Brighton a couple of years ago.
Yeah.
And it's that thing, I get a bit kind of, you know, if you meet people like that, it can go one or two ways.
Yes.
You go well, or generally speaking, it'll be very quick and embarrassing.
Yeah.
Mm. And, you know, you saw like DJ Lord walking past and then Flav walking past and there's always, oh, Chuck's there. I thought, let's go and get a photo.
Yeah.
You know, I don't usually like to do that sort of thing, but sometimes you think, let's just do it.
It's Chuck D for fuck's sake.
It's Chuck D, exactly. And there was a guy this sort of vague queue formed, that sort of thing. There was a guy in front of me, put his arms around Chuck and went, I've seen you play 3 times.
Oh, God.
And I just, oh, God, I don't know why I'm saying this. I went there, put my arm around him, went, I've seen you 5 times.
Oh, my God.
And then kind of immediately thought,
what was his reaction?
God.
Just a little nod.
Yeah, there was just a very, I don't even know what the action was, because I quickly ran away again, thinking he must never know my face.
Oh, my God. Just Chuck D sitting there getting a series of numbers whispered in his ear.
What in your head would have been the perfect thing to say? Like, even when you're walking away.
Let's do an LP together, and, you know, and he'd say yes, and everything will be great.
He'd say yes, but only if it's got a shitty pun in the title.
Oh, God, yeah.
This is the part of the show when we ask how did you get into hip-hop?
So, anyway, we're supposed to talk about your relationship with hip-hop. So, kind of. How did you get into it in the first instance?
How did I get into it? I think, you know, it was probably the, you know, quite early on in the sort of, you know, when the first sort of recorded hip-hop was coming over here and that sort of thing. But at that time, sort of the early 80s, musically, it was all sort of Tribes. And at that point, I decided that I was a rockabilly.
Right.
So it was actually my brother that really got, you know, he was more, you know, he was into hip-hop and things like that. And things being slightly, you know, you could not cross the line.
Yeah.
I was, you know, I had a quiff and things like that. But I was sort of hearing this stuff and thinking, oh, it's interesting. Now, my brother was, you know, bringing back sort of, but it was all, it's all things like kind of, a lot of this sort of lightly cheesy end, like Break Machine.
Right.
Things like that.
Yeah.
But I remember, you know, I sort of listened to sort of Beatbox by the Art of Noise when that came out. And I remember having it on my Walkman at school.
Hiding, secretly listening.
And my rockabilly friend came up to me and just went off my head.
Oh,
what are you listening
shit.
To? I was like, oh, God, no. And he's like, what the hell's this? And I sort of tried to get around it by going, well, the bit at the start of Beatbox is kind of got a 12-bar blues bass line thing. So that's kind of why I got into it.
Yeah.
And, you know, the game was up, the jig was up. And so, it's got a... got into it a bit after that, really. So it's kind of almost second-handery via my brother. And we shared a room, so, you know, we'd always end up, you know, arguing about who was playing, you know, who was going to play the Stray Cats and who was going to play Houdini and that sort of thing.
I remember, like, everyone at my school, like, when I first got into hip-hop, being into the Smiths.
All right.
And then I sort of was too nervous to say I was into hip-hop. So I said to a guy, oh, can I borrow your Smiths album? I really, like, really want to check him out. And then borrowed it and didn't listen because I didn't have any interest in listening to it at all. And then sort of gave it back to him. And I said, oh, it's great. It was amazing. It was really good. And he goes, really? Because it's like exactly the same point as... I should have like forwarded it on or something like that.
It was
a cassette, yeah.
Oh, right.
And I was like, oh, cool. But I just listened to it exactly once.
You should have recorded over it.
Like,
put a load of hip-hop on there for
him. Marked it off, right. Yeah. I listened to it to this. Aha!
So, and what was? Do you remember what your first album that you really bought and got into was?
I would probably guess. As I said, I remember owning. I remember having the album Kingdom Blow, Curtis Blow album.
Yes, yeah.
And it's, you know, it's okay. Yeah. That sort of thing. But weird, I think the one track I listened to all the time on it was actually kind of an instrumental called Unity Party Jam.
Right. He'll be unhappy to hear that.
He will be unhappy to hear that because it was just, you know, the one instrumental track on the Curtis Blow album. But then I remember getting Licensed to Ill, really.
Right.
And I remember, you know, in a way that I can't remember if I bought it or my brother bought it, but I remember you took it home, stuck it on my little Panasonic plasticky tray, you know, the tray comes out and you stick the record on.
Yeah.
And just blasting it out full blast and just leaping about the room doing the Alibaba and the 40 Thieves things for that before my mum came up and just said, turn that brain on. And when I'm on the mic, the suckers run. Word. Surprised you're on my team. But I remember that and just, you know, that point and that whole sort of, you know, that whole era, you know, Def Jam era. The sort of, what we might call the second golden age.
Yes.
We're a bit of golden ages, man.
Yeah.
Like that sort of original, you know, the original golden age and then the sort of a Def Jam.
Hip hop has a lot of golden ages and a lot of deaths. Those are the two things that happen to hip hop a lot. Do you know what I mean?
They do.
It's like boom bust cycle.
Yeah.
With hip hop. Did you watch the documentary, the Netflix thing, that evolution of hip hop?
Yes. Yeah. Yeah.
So first of all, I felt bad because I didn't realise how much of a megastar Curtis Blow was at the time. Because did you see him in it? He's still got like he was wearing like a full like velour tracksuit and
still
a captain.
Sort of busting out 80s style.
Yeah. But I didn't realise that at the time he was like the first kind of megastar, wasn't he? Yeah.
Yeah, really the first solo. You know, hip hop artist to break through.
Yeah,
and I think it was the first. Wasn't this Christmas Rapping? Was the first,
yes, that's right. Yeah,
the first
track
on British hip hop.
Because he was
British
on Top
TV.
Of the Pops, wasn't it?
Yeah,
it was mad.
Christmas Rapping.
It was so mad. It's so
and
funny.
You wonder why people thought, well, this is just a novelty. It won't last.
Christmas Rapping. I mean, that
it's
is
never on any of those. Christmas
that is a Roomage worthy pun title for a song, isn't it? But the other thing that was sort of, you know, it's funny because you mentioned Licence to Ill. Is the Beastie Boys, I didn't realise until I watched that how sort of manufactured, not that their sound was, but like they had to be very careful on how they were marketed and stuff, didn't they? Like they sort of, it was very deliberate the way that they're put out of these kind of party white boys or whatever, do you know what I mean? It was.
It was. Well, obviously, you know, they were a kind of punk band before, weren't they?
Yeah.
But yeah, it was very, you know, very much sort of Rick Rubin. Mm. Orchestrated thing, isn't it? It's like, okay, you've got to be like lunatics, you know, pissing beer over everyone.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah,
you've got to be just mental.
Yeah, and then Rick Rubin and Russell Simmons, who are now, they're both controversial for different reasons, aren't they? I say controversial.
Isn't Simmons on...
Russell Simmons. Is,
yeah.
Have you got a controversy? It's a.
What's
convicted?
Is he being accused?
I as soon as I started talking about this, I immediately became nervous because I don't know sufficient details to really. But so this is all in lieu of me making a legal background check.
I'd like to point out I know nothing about any of this.
Okay, so Russell Simmons has been accused of
allegedly,
possibly, sort of sexual kind of. Right. Unwanted sexual advances, and I hate to say this sort of now because I don't know the facts. Apparently, it was all alongside Mr. B, the Gentleman Rhymer, that he sort of conducted most of these activities. So
he said, "I heard you met Chuck D."
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. He doesn't want to talk. He doesn't want to talk to you anymore. But
so Russell Simmons has got that. But the other thing is, Rick Rubin is like some right wing.
Right.
Apparently,
he's gone full sort of. He's
apparently, yeah.
He's grown philosophically into his look.
Yes, basically, basically that is what's happened. It's like they like he's on Twitter. And has only like tweeted a couple of times, and both of those times were to endorse some right wing kind of ideology or something. And then he's deleted it,
right.
So he's in a bit of shit as well.
He's just a sort of late night drunken right wing.
I guess so. We've all done that, haven't we? I've all like retweeted some anti-immigrant thing when I've had a couple of bevvies. Do you know what I mean? It's normally Red Stripe that gets me. And do you listen to hip hop now as much as you did then, or have you sort of gone away from it and come back to it, or not even come back?
Well,
to
there's
it?
Been endless goings away and comings back, like very much like the golden ages.
Yeah,
I've been listening to lots of kind of what you might call the LA beats sort of thing.
Right.
Lots of I remember seeing there was a video of this guy called Just Rain.
Yeah.
Who's kind of a funny YouTuber sort of bloke, and there was a video of these two guys trying to dance kind of. Looking at each other dancing in a car park in Toronto.
I've seen that. It's incredible. Yeah,
it's really great.
And it ends up there. For ages.
Then it sort of ends up as this weird little love story thing.
Yeah.
But there's a track behind that. I just thought this is a really great track. And it turned out it was by girl called DJ Ellie, and she put together these compilations called Culture. And they are this sort of just like largely, again, instrumental.
Yeah.
As a rapper, it's very odd that I almost entirely listen to instrumental hip hop.
Yeah.
And it's just lots of very wonky, sort of that kind of slightly sort of Jay Dillerish off the beat. You know, everything's all the beats are all over the place.
Yeah.
But it's I've been listening to loads and loads of that. It's almost all I listen to now is that sort of LA beat, sort of lo-fi hip hop.
It's interesting. Well, like the thing about listening to instrumental hip hop, which I think most of the people I know have started listening to instrumental hip hop later on. Like they started off listening to, you know, stuff with vocals on it, or whatever, and then sort of dabbled in like listening to instrumental hip hop. And the weird thing about it is that I think it's a slightly different experience, because a lot of those tracks, when they start, about 30 seconds in, they've basically done everything they're going to do. Do you know what I mean? And then you're just going to hear that for the rest of the track.
Yeah.
And so it's kind of a bit of a different listening experience, isn't it?
Yeah.
Do you know what I mean? And it's more sort of like, the truth is, how I started getting into it is I read something about how having music in the background can help you concentrate when you're writing and shit like that.
Right, okay, yeah.
So
what,
I
music without lyrics?
The thing is, I started just putting hip-hop on and became like immediately distracted by it and just thought this isn't really working. And then I tried instrumental hip-hop, and actually it does work. It's great. It's great, man. Like you sort of get into a zone, and you sort of are kind of conscious of the music, but it does help. It's much
better.
Because
of the sort of looping nature of it or something.
I don't know. It's just like having that in the background.
And then you find that everything you write is in sort of 16 bars of rhymes.
I've written an hour's tour show about Dilla. So I don't
know. It does. It really works.
And is there anything that you don't... we always ask people like this because I'm sort of obsessed with... trap and like mumble rap and all that kind of stuff.
Right.
Do you listen to any, do you dabble in any of that at all?
Not usually. A lot of the instrumental stuff is almost, you know, it's got that sort of very slow 808, you know, snappy 808 snares all over the place, but very little with vocals on it. I mean, some of it does have a bit of auto-tuned general gubbins over the top.
Yeah.
Like, you know, I do like, you know, things like Lady Leisure, the sort of Queen's Speech video she did are just brilliant.
Yes.
And I kind of love her slightly brummy, the kind of brummy take on it.
Yes.
Headstock of football boot it. I don't know why you really wanna do this. But RIP to your music. Wait too up, no peace, no deuces. You're a little beg, beggars come and choosers. Hitting with a new thing, call it exclusive. Don't need backing, I could do it in acoustic. Rag off. Billie Jean that gal. Moonwalk on her. She will get better. Gotta get a slap on her head back.
I tried to recently. Have you tried to listen to the Migos album?
No.
So I decided to try, and basically somebody said to me that I was being a judgmental prick, right? That for not listening to it. So I thought to myself, I'm going to try and get into some of this, right? So I started listening to Future.
Right, yes.
And
this, Future is an ongoing theme of this podcast.
I know, it does get mentioned.
Always let's get into Future.
So I tried to get into Future, and I tried that before, but that didn't happen. Then I started listening to the new Migos album. And what you say is true. The beats are all incredible. Like, they're all really good, but I just...
wouldn't say...
everything else about it is shit. So that's...
that's your Migos stuff.
Yeah.
It almost feels like a waste. It's a waste of a beat.
Yes.
If you get that Danny Brown on the top or something like that, it's magic.
I know.
But, yeah.
Oh, man. Hip-hop grapes.
Is there anything about hip-hop that you don't like?
Well, I suppose in a way we've covered a lot, you know, with the hip hop was to blame after all. That's definitely a gripe. But the fact there's so, and I think, you know, the fact that Kendrick's managed to break through and things like that and be a huge star is kind of a miracle in this day and age.
Yes.
Because he's a proper artist and he's, you know, he's up there. But, you know, just the way that it's, you know, what you tend to see and hear is controlled by a small group of people who don't care about the music particularly.
Yeah.
And that sort of thing.
Well, it's interesting because, like, since this podcast has come out, like, since we started doing it, you get people that are sort of that are aging B-boys, I guess, for want of a different phrase, who just sort of used to listen to it and have sort of gone away from it, and it sort of reminds them of stuff they used to listen to. There's a lot of people that sort of say there isn't any good hip-hop now, and that just simply isn't the case.
No,
you know
that
I mean?
Is really They're, not. I mean, I think, in a way, I think we could be, you know, we could be heading towards another golden age.
Yeah,
maybe,
I think. Totally
There's a
agree
lot of really, really, really good stuff around.
And we've instigated that.
Yes, yeah. I do. I don't want to overstate it, but I do think it is mainly because of this podcast.
You are the kind of Africa Bambaataa or podcast.
Yes,
podcast,
correct. Although allegations notwithstanding.
Yeah. But yeah. Yeah, anyway.
This might not go out.
We're going to get about 10 minutes of this podcast. But also, as far as gripes go, there's always the live hip-hop gripe.
Yes.
A couple of which being, one is, I went to see De La Soul when they did 3 Feet High and Rising.
Right.
It was great. Saw them at the, I think it was the Town and Country Club in the Forum in Kentish Town.
Yeah.
And it was brilliant. Then I saw them a few years after that and they'd done that full, like, just play the song.
Yeah.
Don't stop it halfway through and go, oh, and then start, you know, doing call and response doing the hokey cokey and things like that. I just want to hear the songs.
Yeah.
That sort of thing. Also, it's possibly, I mean, it's not necessarily a gripe, but I do tend to find with hip-hop, it's like, let's just have the breaks and the samples. Yeah. Don't bring drums and guitars and bass in and things like that, in a way, because it's sort of, I don't know, I tend to find hip-hop live is, you know, should just be a DJ.
Oh, I see,
and that's the thing with Public Enemy bringing, you know, they have a drummer and things like that.
Yeah.
It sounds fine, but it's not as sort of visceral as that.
No,
the breakbeat.
Yes, I totally agree with you. But the other thing that is that I sort of feel with that is it's slightly like when they do that, they feel like it's more arty. You know, like it suddenly.
Yeah, we're musicians.
Yes, it's like when I went to see Jay-Z and at the Royal Albert Hall, and he had an orchestra doing all the backing tracks, and everybody was sort of like, you know what, that's amazing. He really is talented. You're like, no. It doesn't make him more talented.
He's just very rich. He can afford to book an orchestra. I'd love to have an orchestra play, but I don't get paid that sort of money.
I know. It's just madness, man. Do you know what I mean? But I mean, are you conscious of that with the live hip hop thing? Are you conscious of that? Because a lot of the time it sounds like they haven't sound checked and stuff like that, and it just like is a bit. Are you conscious of that when you do your live shows? Or do you not give a fuck? You just think everyone else is doing it shit. I might as well phone it in as well.
Depends on the gig.
In a way. Well, no, I think, you know, I always give it 100%.
Yeah. Because you're doing everything yourself.
Yeah.
Is it, how much do you engage with the audience?
I do. You know, the thing, I do lots of, this is the, you know, the thing, I'll do sort of hip-hop gigs or, you know, just toilet venue gigs. Or right. I do a lot of sort of cabaret and, you know, that sort of thing. And you have to get the audience involved a bit.
Yeah.
And I do call and response, but within the song.
Yes.
Within the song.
And it all has sort of an artistic and political kind of bent to it, doesn't it?
Well,
and you're very much about getting a message across.
Yes.
Much as Rupert is, whenever he speaks so profoundly as he tends to.
Thank you.
I went to see Buck 65.
Oh, yes.
And it was just him over like a desk sort of noodling. And it was good. The music was good and it all sounded good. But he didn't really engage with. I mean, he could have been just doing that in his room. Mm. Like, it was good.
Right,
but, like,
yeah.
He was so into what he was doing. It was sort of like an art installation. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah,
like,
yeah.
Where he was just doing his thing and we were sort of incidental to it. But it still was good.
Well, I often think of, you know, like getting some more stuff up on the stage and doing that sort of thing. And,
yeah.
You know, I got one of these little Roland SP-404 things that seem to be really popular with lots of hip-hop DJs now because they have all these crazy, you know, DJ effects you can slap on things.
Right.
But then, I think, like you said, in practice, you know, in my head, I think that's going to look great. I'll be doing stuff on stage.
Yeah.
They're going to go, oh, all the audience will be going, wow, what's he doing? That sounds amazing. I could well be doing nothing. But, I think in practice, it's just, you are just a bloke on stage noodling about.
I always feel self-conscious about doing stand-up and just how little spectacle or theatre there is to it. And I remember, like, when I did Edinburgh one year, they did this, it was like my first solo show in Edinburgh. And it's like Mervyn Stutter's Pick of the Fringe. Do you know that?
I've done that.
Yeah, yeah. So he got me to, like that, whatever, they asked me to go and do 5 minutes. So I stood backstage and I watched the act that was on before me, and it was some of the most beautiful shadow puppet theatre I'd ever seen in my life. And I was just watching it, and there were people fucking crying in the audience. And I'm stood there going, what am I supposed to do here, man?
Are you ready to laugh?
Because that was spectacular, wasn't it? So I just need the mic and the stand, and I'm just going to whinge for 5 minutes. We'll see how it goes, shall we?
Plug one, plug two, guest plugs for you.
Right, we're out of time, unfortunately. Oh. But is there anything? Thank you very much. You've been a splendid guest. Rupert, you've been fantastic as well.
But it has been very good.
I think you'll join in with me in saying that Mr. B, the best guest we've ever had.
The best.
Yeah, yeah, amazing. Well,
public NAB number one.
Pardon?
Public NAB number one.
Very good. And he finishes it off with a little, another extra little turd there to put on the top of a,
big turd.
I might have to say that I cannot claim responsibility entirely for this being the best one. I think we actually...
Yes, it's a team, it's a team.
Is there anything you want to plug before we go? Because we're big time.
I brought along a couple of prezzies for you. I've got my Mr. B's, the Chap Hop songbook.
Thank you very much.
Fetch them out of the bag.
Yeah. So is this available in all good bookstores now?
No, I don't think they'd want anything to do with it. It's just on from gentlemanrhymer.com.
Oh, okay, great. Thank you
all
so
lovingly
much.
Illustrated. By my own hand as well.
Is this really your stuff? Wow. Yeah. Can you buy the music directly from your website? Is that the best way to get it?
You can get CDs on the website. CDs.
Yeah.
And it's all on iTunes and Spotify and all that sort of thing.
Do you want people to listen to it on Spotify?
If they like.
Right.
I mean, yeah, if they must.
Okay, fine.
I'll get you.
If you must, if you don't give a shit about somebody making a living,
exactly.
Then listen to it on Spotify.
This is available on Spotify, isn't it?
Yeah.
Yeah.
They fucking put my tour show on Spotify, mate. I didn't even fucking know. It wasn't sanctioned. Do you know what I mean? Anyway.
On that cliffhanger.
Yes. Thank you so much for joining us. We really appreciate it.
It's an absolute pleasure. Thank you for having me.
And what a pleasure to be sat alongside Roomage. Thank you so much, brother.
An honour.
Yeah.
Cheers, guys.
Okay. Bye.